Derby 104.
Well, hello, good morning. It's Abbey 104 on Sunday morning at 11.06. That means it's time for Folk Tales with me, Terry Bennett. And in the studio this morning, I have André Durand. Have I got the pronunciation right, André?
Yes, you do, Terry. Good morning, Terry.
Good morning.
André Durand.
Durand,
yes. It's a
yes.
French name.
French-Canadian, yes.
No, just properly French.
Okay.
I'm not a French-Canadian at all.
Okay. Now, André, you are certainly an artist.
Yes, I'm definitely an artist.
There's no arguing about
bread.
That.
Yeah, definitely.
And you have had an exhibition in Sherborne for the past number of weeks, haven't you?
Well, past number of months. Actually. Mm. I've had these two allegories. And allegories are definitely not portraits, by the way. It's a completely different, it's a fantasy world of portraiture, let's say.
Yes.
And Princess Diana is the subject of both of them. And I've depicted her in both of the paintings, which are very large, I might add, as the goddess Diana, the Roman goddess Diana.
Yeah.
And these pictures have been on display, I think, now for... show just closed, but 2 or 3 months.
Yes. And these are the latest in quite a body of work for you, and you've been painting since very early age, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been painting since I was a little boy, 4 years old, I would think.
Right. Yeah.
But interestingly, the Diana portraits are part of this marvelous inspiration I found here in Dorset, which is, I would say, mystical, spiritual, not easy to define, not specific places necessarily. And I've set both allegories of Princess Diana in the Dorset landscape. In one, she's hunting over by the Cerne giant.
Yes.
She looks quite fearsome in that one.
Yeah.
And the other, she's just kind of like an apparition in the landscape, happily, very in the landscape very near Cerne Abbas, in fact.
And we'll come on to those a little later in the interview, and I'd like to know what inspired you to come to Dorset and paint them, as opposed to wherever else you might have gone.
Right.
But you have been an artist, as we say, for many, many, well, all your working life, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, both my parents were very artistic, and they certainly nurtured the talent that I obviously had since I was a little boy. I've never ever thought of myself as anything else but a painter, an artist, and
that was always going to be your
career. It was very, very clear from the very beginning. I mean, it seemed like a very risky thing when you're born in a little middle-class town like Ottawa in Canada, or it was then. I don't know. It might be a great city now, for all I know.
We'll come back and talk about this in due course, but worth mentioning also, you've painted John Paul II, the Pope.
I did. John Paul II, Saint John Paul II.
As he now is, yes.
Which he is now. I think I'm the only artist that may well have painted a Pope. I mean, not a Pope, but a saint.
A saint,
yes. A sainted Pope. Yes, I did. He granted me 3 audiences in the Vatican in 1982.
Yes.
And I produced this, well, really extraordinary painting that had changed my life in a way. You know.
All right, we'll come and talk about that in a minute. And also the Dalai Lama, who was another subject of yours, wasn't
he? Yes, I painted oddly enough, I had a commission to paint the Dalai Lama at exactly the same time as I had the commission to paint the Pope. And when I went to have my first audience with the Dalai Lama, I was entering the convent in San Anselmo in Rome, where he was staying, and I saw this car leaving. And I looked. My goodness, that's the Dalai Lama. He's supposed to be posing for me right now.
Where's he going?
But yeah, where is he going? And I was reassured by my driver. He said, he's going to see the Pope. Right. It's his audience. So.
Fair enough. Look, we'll come back, as I say, and talk about all of that. But let's take your first track. And this one, perhaps unsurprisingly, is Diana.
It had to be, didn't
by
it?
By Paul Anka.
Yeah.
So
another Ottawa boy who was preoccupied with a Diana.
Sure. And this is a favourite of yours, is it?
Well, I just, in view of this program, I suddenly remembered it, and I thought, my goodness, there are two of us with Italian connections who, you know, made a lot out of Diana.
All right, Diana by Paul Anka.
I'm so young and you're so old. This, my darling, I've been told. I don't care just what they say, 'cause forever I will pray. You and I, we will be as free as the birds up in the trees. Oh, please stay by me, Diana. Thrills I get when you hold me close. Oh, my darling, you're the most. I love you, but you love me. Oh, Diana, can't you see? I love you with all my heart, and I hope we will never part. Oh, please stay by me, Diana. Oh, my darling, oh, my lover, tell me that there is no other. I love you with my heart. Oh, 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 don't you know I love you so, and only you can take my heart. Only you can tear it apart. When you hold me in your loving arms, I can feel you giving all your charms. Hold me, darling, hold me tight. Squeeze me, baby, with all your might. Oh, please stay by me, Diana. Oh, please, Diana. Oh, please.
That's Paul Anka there and Diana, and that was from 1957, and of course that was 4 years before Diana, Princess of Wales, was even born, so hardly likely to be referring to her, is it? So. And we should say that in the studio we have an extra guest today in the shape of Pepe.
Pepe is my little German pincher. I think everybody in Sherborne has got to know him now. Pepe is from Rome. I bought him out of a basket of other little pinchers. He was the only black one, and he was in the middle. And I wanted a dog rather than a bitch, and he happened to be a dog. And I just bought him like that, just on instinct. I've always had dogs in my life, always. And I can't imagine life without a dog, really. It would be, I don't know. But Pepe is one of the most vibrant. He's small. I kept thinking he'll grow a little bit, you know, but he didn't. He's the smallest of his litter. He's the little runt. And he's got the biggest brain you could imagine a dog have. He's very easy to get a sense of you're really with someone. He's very responsive, alert, friendly. We go all over Sherborne together, and I never go anywhere without him, really, or very, very rarely.
Well, he's quite a character, certainly.
He certainly is.
Anyway, back to your life story. And you were born in Ottawa, as we've already reflected, in Canada.
The thing that I thought was amusing when I was preparing my thoughts for this program of yours, Terry, was that this Diana, Paul Anka, who was, you know, like a big thing, had this Diana song that made him world famous, you know. And that's what's happened with my Diana paintings. They've made me certainly well known all over the world.
Okay, tell me about early life. What about your parents? Were they artistic?
Yes, both of my parents were artistic, And part of the great harmony of our home when I was a child was that they worked together on projects. My mother had a wonderful color sense in painting, but she would say she had no imagination. And my father could draw like Raphael, but he had a lot of imagination, but he could not have any idea how to make a color alive and work with. So my mom and dad worked together on paintings, which is a wonderful experience to see the cooperation there can be between artists. And they did productions in the theater and things together. And so I had that atmosphere from, when I was 3, 4, 5 years of age.
And your mother, I think you said, was from a quite prominent Canadian family, yes?
Well, both my parents were, they were actually rather prominent. But my mother's family was a very prominent Irish family from Montreal. And they owned the racetracks there called the Mount Royal Racetrack. And they were in sports. And they owned, my mother's family owned the Boston Bruins as well. And that was her side of the family, although they were very, very artistic. Art was always a priority in our life. Mm. My father played the violin beautifully, you know.
And I think you said your father had some connection with Pierre Trudeau, who's the father of the
current
premier.
They were both
premier.
At school together. Daddy was with Pierre Trudeau at school, and when this... I wasn't there. I left Canada when I was about... Well, when I got married, maybe 17, I left. Mm-hmm. But my father worked with Pierre Trudeau with the translations that had to be forced on everybody from, you know, everybody had to suddenly start speaking French. And my father worked on the legal documents. And they seemed to be on rather friendly terms, yes. Mm-hmm.
Tell me about school days for you, because you were at school in Ottawa.
But yeah, I did. I was in school in Ottawa. I was at a Catholic private school as a little wee boy. Yes. Had nuns teaching me who were very nice, and priests. None of them ever molested me, I might
good
add.
To hear.
So I came out unscathed from that, and then I went to Ottawa University and got my degree there.
And a degree in arts?
Well, it was general. It was general at that point. And at that point, it took me to the decision-making time. And of course, being an artist, I suppose I was an artist, and I don't believe that artists can be trained, or you either have the talent and you're born with it and it becomes your priority in life. It's not something you can take on board later on. I really don't believe that, because that's why all this rubbish we see around right now is lack of talent, lack of culture, lack of ignorance, really, of art in its, you know. And I think that one's just been very fortunate that I had this environment to grow up in. And so when I got to the deciding point, I went to my father and I said, thinking of being a lawyer. And Daddy, I met him in his office. He was always sort of more serious for a man-to-man talk with my dad. And he said, Andre, are you in your right mind? He said, with your talent, how could you even think of doing anything else but make your life as a painter? And I was really taken aback that Daddy wanted me to take the plunge and try such a risky kind of way to live. Mm. He said, you're so young. If it doesn't work, well, you know, do something else. But right now, go for it. Be an artist. Do what you want, what you're gifted for, what your passion is. Live it. And he said to me, when you do something I like, he said, I'm not going to give you any money, by the way. He said, you won't be able to live in the style to which you're accustomed. Because he said, and I'm very glad of this advice now, because he said to me, you know, if you can't make a living as a painter, then it's not worth doing it. But he said, I will buy, when I see a painting I like, I'll buy them from you. He said, but I want a prix d'ami. So off I went with brush in hand, brushes, and I went off to Europe immediately.
Can you remember the first time you set brush to canvas, as it were?
I can. And there's a process, because first my father had me working on panel, you know, those sort of canvas panels that are on cardboard. Mm-hmm. And I was painting animals all the time, and I was painting pictures after Audubon, James Audubon, I think he was English, but he was an American in America, and he painted American animals and birds, and I used them as an example, and I copied them. And then Daddy, at a certain point in time, said, I think you're ready to have a real canvas. And he said, you'll find that's a very different experience, Andre, because it's rather like painting on skin. Canvas gives. And it's a very sensual experience. I don't know that he put it, he said sensual experience, but he said, you'll find it a very intimate experience. And there, and he had hidden in his trunk of his car, actually, a couple of large canvases. He brought them in produced. And he said, now do it.
I see. And so, did you find it as sensual as he?
Yeah, I do to this day, Terry. Mm. Painting in oil on canvas. I mean, I know many of the painters I love and many of the paintings I really enjoy are painted on panel. Mm-hmm. But I find the rigidity of the panel very unsympathetic, and I love the give of canvas. It is truly like touching the skin in a kind of a way with a brush. Mm. And it allows such wonderful brushstroke, which I think is the real signature of the artist, is the brush work. You know.
Yeah. Those days, you look back on them as happy days, school days and
happy.
Childhood.
It's when I think of life in general and what paradise. It was like living in another, and my parents loved each other. I was the apple of their eye. It was really lovely, and it's the kind of basis that I think has made it possible to endure what is a really very difficult life as an artist for all sorts of reasons.
You appreciated when you took up your father's suggestion then, that it was risky.
He was right. It was really very risky, and I don't think that, I'm not very much in favour of grants and all those kind of things, because I think a so-called artist, and I think that's a very hackneyed word nowadays that's become, but really should face the challenge of making, have no grants, have nothing, just try to do it and see whether you can sell it. Mm-hmm. And if you can, that's a good testing ground, experience. Yeah.
Let's break there and have your second track, which is Lou Reed. Why this one?
Lou Reed came to my studio when he was on a tour in London. He came to my studio in London. I can't remember exactly the date, but I was mesmerized by this little man who looked like punk well before we heard of punk. He had black painted fingernails. I didn't really know who he was. He just arrived at 5:30 in the morning with a friend of mine. And he came in the studio, and he was silent, and he had that charismatic presence that his silence was infectious. You know, we just all sat there. I was sort of, what's this guy thinking? And he looked at the painting so closely, went up and scrutinized some. And then he sat himself down, and he still didn't say anything. And then he said, well, Andy thinks he's killed art of painting, but this is something else, Andre. This is something else. I never forgot that.
He was impressed.
He was very impressed, yes. I spent the whole of his time there, his tour in London. I spent the whole of the time with him, actually.
All right, this is Walk on the Wild Side.
Yeah, brilliant song. Brilliant words, lyrics, yeah.
Loveliness of it.
Holly came from Miami, FLA. Hitchhiked her way across USA. Plucked her eyebrows on the way. Shaved her legs and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey honey, take a walk on the wild side. Can Andy came from out on the island. In the back room, she was everybody's darling. But she never lost her head, even when she was given head. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls go do 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 do. Once gave it away. Everybody had to pay and pay. A hustle here and a hustle there. New York City is the place where they said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey Joe, take a walk on the wild side. Sugar Plum Fairy came and hit the streets, looking for soul food and a place to eat. Went to the Apollo, you should have seen him go, go, go. They said, hey sugar, take a walk on the wild side. I said, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side.
Painting and trying to make your life as an artist is like taking a walk on the wild side. And it has to be that, I think.
Well, that was Lou Reed with that track from 1972, as chosen by André Durand, who is my guest in the studio today on Folk Tales. And André, we got to the bit where you were at university. You left university, and
yeah, I got off, and I won a Canada Council grant,
right?
Quite unexpectedly, because I hadn't asked to do the normal thing. I wanted to look at the paintings in Western European art galleries from Scotland, London, you know, right down to Rome and all Berlin, all the really great collections, European collections. I wanted to just look at the paintings. And I had two subjects that I proposed to the Canada Council, which one would think, well, they just weren't done in those days. The first one was I wanted to do a paper, which I ended up doing, on Michelangelo as a colorist, which nobody thought of as a colorist in those days, and on the lost paintings, the Ultima Maniera, the lost paintings of Titian, who lived to a lofty age of 100. And that was another subject that was not really Canada Council thinking. But I won the grant. I won the grant hands down, and I won all the prizes at school. And I thought, didn't know what's happening to me, but I guess I've chosen the right move, made the right move. Thank you, Daddy.
So you'll always be grateful for that advice given
to you. I'm always grateful for the advice my parents gave me, yes.
But you found yourself then post-university and with a grant, so that sort of determined which direction you were going to go.
It did. I got married. Mm-hmm. I married... a Greek Russian girl called Ludmila Temerte. Yeah. And we came off to Europe immediately on my Canada Council grant. And we landed in London, obviously, first thing.
Is that your first trip to London?
Of course. I'd never been to Europe before. I'd been to Europe a million times in my mind since I first saw beautiful paintings in an art book. But no, that was my very first time.
And you said to me offline that you love London. You regard that as your, well, now your primary home. I think
I'm a Londoner. London made me. I mean,
so what was it about London to a fairly impressionable 20-something-year-old that landed here?
Really, the Canada Council grant was one thing, but I was then had the great good fortune of meeting Charles Ritchie. Who's a rather celebrated Canadian. He's written a marvelous book called The Siren Years. And Charles was the High Commissioner, the Canadian High Commissioner to the Court of St. James. And he said, I met him in Washington, actually, and he said, you must come to London. He said, you'll be able to develop this extraordinary talent you have, and I will be able to nurture it by introductions to, well, a lot of very interesting people, including Princess Margaret and the Sitwells and all. Yeah. But so, yes, I came along with Charles then to London. And I was actually living with his niece, Elizabeth Ritchie. And Charles just plunged me into the deep end of London society immediately.
How did you find that?
I found that exciting. I loved meeting these people. I thought, you know, I've read about you, I've read your stuff, I've looked at whatever it is you've done. And then to actually be meeting the real thing, it was very, very exciting. I loved it.
And how did that lead to work?
Well, Elizabeth, Charles's niece, set me up in a studio in London. We had this, and I had a marvelous studio in Clareville Grove, a really beautiful, huge place to paint. It was a double studio. There was a wonderful piano downstairs where people like Alfred Brendel used to rehearse. And it was just wonderful. It's all I can say. The challenge of London, the sort of meeting so many diversified people, the social skills one acquired overnight, it was just thrilling.
So a very rewarding and...
Definitely a right career move, I guess, is what they call it. And it was marvelous, too, because Elizabeth Ritchie said to me, Audrey, now what would you like to paint? And I said, well, I think what I'd like to paint wouldn't sell. And she said, well, I will sponsor you. I will patronize you. What would you like to paint? And so I started my life in London, and I was really very young, and I started by doing a series of paintings I called The Trojans. And they were large canvases, 54 by 60 inches. I remember the size of it so very well. And they depicted events that I felt were archetypal from the great epic of Homer, the Iliad. And I was also at the time very influenced by Pompeian painting. So I was bringing, these paintings are rather flat, very little landscape. They're very rather like Pompeian painting. And I did a series of 14 of them, which took me a couple of years into... Of course, I painted portraits all the time to make a living, but it left me plenty of time to do the Trojan
pictures. These were the expression of your... where you wanted to go.
This is where I wanted to go. Mm. I've always been interested in myth, mythology. I don't like the word mythology, but say the Greek religion, the Christian religion. I think all of them offer us narratives that are so exciting and so evocative and so within us. Within human nature, let us say, that that's what I wanted to paint, those kind of paintings.
And
I'm doing them now in Dorset.
Yes, and the portrait.
Portrait painting was an idea of my mother, and she had an amazing ability to get a likeness. She showed me how to get a likeness in about 2 days. And she said, Andre, you're going to need to have these magnificent paintings you're doing of myth and mythology are all very fine and well, but they're not that easy to sell.
No.
And she said, you know, if you're going to be in England, especially in England, she said, the English like portraits. So you must learn how to do them.
More good parental advice.
Oh, very good. Again, yes, I'm very, very grateful for having the parents I did. And Mum was absolutely right. I could do a couple of portraits, and that would allow me to do 6 or 8 mythological paintings without worrying about selling them, but just doing what I wanted to do.
And with the mythological paintings, did you find a market for those?
Well, oddly enough, yes. Mm-hmm. I did. That was the extraordinary thing. It often worked like this. A subject would be posing in the studio, and they'd see the other, you know, the mythological paintings around the... And they'd say, oh, how much is that one? I think I'll have one of those. And so the portraits worked in the sense of bringing people, making people receptive to the mythological subjects. And they bought them. And so, yeah, it worked. It's always worked like that, very, very successfully. But the portraiture seems to be the doorway.
What happened after that? I mean, you famously painted in 1972, wasn't it? Elizabeth Bowen, wasn't it?
Elizabeth Bowen.
Who is an Irish...
An Irish novelist. And last book she wrote was Eva Trout. And that was a book that was based on the lady, Elizabeth Ritchie, who was Charles Ritchie's niece. And okay. I met Elizabeth through Charles Ritchie, and she championed me. I can remember her introducing me to Kenneth Clark, who has been an enormous influence on my life. Well, I should say his book on the nude is an enormous influence on me to this day. And Elizabeth rather championed me among, you know, sort of her set, the Bloomsbury set, I guess they were. I can't remember all of them. And her portrait was so successful. It was, she loved it. Everybody that I painted it for loved it, and it's now, to this day, one of the most popular paintings in the National Portrait Gallery in London.
And if we jump ahead a little bit, that was 1972. In the early 80s, you came to paint both Pope John Paul and the Dalai Lama, didn't you?
Yes, and so, Mother Teresa, and the Grand Master of the Knights of Malta, Prince of Colonna.
Projecting from one to the other, by then you obviously had pretty well-established reputation.
I did.
Not everybody gets to paint the Pope.
No. And you know, I can remember as a boy in Ottawa, the nuns, so I was that young, I had nuns teaching me, and they said, well, who do you think you are? What do you want to do? And I said, I want to paint the Pope. And so I did. Turned out I did.
Tell me how that came about.
That came about by a request to from a man called Andrew Czochaniewiecki. He's a Polish nobleman and a knight of Malta. And he went to the National Gallery and spoke to, a great champion of mine, Cecil Gould, who was the keeper of Italian paintings at the National Gallery at that time. At the National Gallery. And he said, who would you recommend to paint a portrait of the Pope? Oh, Cecil said, it's got to be André Durand. For starters, he can really draw. And he said, I think he's sort of the Catholic faith. Kind of, you know.
That helps.
And he said, no, there only is one person who's got the right mentality for this job, Andrew, and that is André Durand. And that's how I got the commission. I just as simple as that, really.
And I imagine that process, you have a fairly limited period of time with your subject.
I have yes. I all through the summer, the audience was were arranged for the autumn, September. And I had all summer to prepare, and this is another thing I'm very grateful for to Andrew Czochaniewiecki, because he said in a very casual way, now can you make me little modelli of what you plan to do and what you plan to paint? And I'd never done that before, and I learned very fast to do that and show them to him. And I had planned to base my portrait of the Pope on the portrait in the National Gallery by Raphael of Julius II. So it was all agreed, you know. I'd had done the sketches, prepared everything. I presume Andrew had shown it to other knights of Malta. I don't know. It wasn't any of my business to ask him. But it was all approved, and off I went. But there was a terrible problem. I was only going to be granted 20 minutes twice with the Pope.
Not a great deal.
Not really enough time in my, you know... So I went immediately to Cecil Gould in the National Gallery. I said, Cecil, what is this? How can I possibly... And he said, how long do you think it took to Raphael to do the drawing at Windsor of Julius II? I said, but yes, but Raphael was in the presence of the Pope all the time. I'm going to be coming cold. 20 minutes. I can't do it. Oh, he said, you're going to do it. Did you ever hear of the camera, André? And I was shocked, because up until then, drawing, you know, one, I didn't even think of using a camera with a painting. Never. And he said, do you not think, Cecil said to me, do you not think that if Raphael had the camera, he wouldn't have used it? You know, the point is to make money and do pictures as fast as you can. Yes. So that summer, before I went down to the Vatican, I learned to use a camera for the first time in my life. And so with a combination of drawings, and because I did drawings as well, and the camera, I managed to get some material to do this portrait of the Pope. But I only had had two audiences, Terry. And when I came back to London, I didn't really have what I needed. I had Mother Teresa, I had the Grand Master of the Order of Malta, I had marvelous material of the Dalai Lama, but not the Pope. And Chanovetsky, Andrew Chanovetsky, he said to me, Andre, what's wrong? Well, the Pope had not posed in what had been agreed. He was supposed to wear a mazzotto and red and the white surplice. But he came in that white, iconic outfit that he wears all the time. And it just took me aback. And I couldn't conceive of it, you know, how to do it. Well, Andrew said, we want the portrait of the Pope. I said, well, I'll have to have another audience. And he said, Andre, this is the Pope. And I said, I know, Andrew, but I need another audience. So he picked up the phone. He called the Jewish, the Pope's assistant, and he said, in Polish, it was all in Polish, of course, got off the phone and said, all right, can you go down next week? I said, yep.
You got your third audience.
And I had the third audience, and I then really realized that I could do a study in white, and I think that's what's unique about my portrait. It's turned out to be a study in various shades of white. And obviously the experience of more contact with the Pope helps a lot. And I discovered the secret of these amazing ridges in his brow, his tiny eyes and tiny nose and a letterbox of a mouth. But he had this amazing forehead with very, very unique wrinkles, I guess. Not wrinkles, just, well, formations. And that is, then I had it.
Yes.
Just like that.
I'm conscious that time is not with us, Andre. Let's have your third track, or a bit of it anyway. This is Pink Floyd, An Eclipse. That was a Pink Floyd and Eclipse, and a bit of a strange ending. That's the last track from the Dark Side of the Moon album from 1973, chosen by my guest in the studio, Andre Droit, who is, an international artist, I suppose you could be described as, really, Andre, couldn't you?
Yeah, I think that's the point, yes.
And, you spend a lot of time in London, in Italy.
London, Rome, Athens, in Europe. I think people accuse me a little bit of being pro-European artist and Europhile, and I take that as a compliment, a great compliment.
Let's move on, because time is marching on, but tell us about how you came to have an involvement with Diana, Princess of Wales, who has been quite a significant part of your latter work, hasn't she? How did that all come about?
Well, if I would say to you, Terry, that it was because I'm a figurative painter, definitely a figurative painter, and I wanted to find subjects which people, everybody, could relate to. And certainly Diana was that, wasn't she? She was sure. The loved by, and it's not even in England, it's all over the world, in Japan, in Korea, in Italy. I mean, so I found a subject, and she just happened to be my neighbor as well, because she was right over in Kensington Palace, and I was about 5 minutes from Kensington Palace when I was living in London. I'd also had the pleasure of meeting her and seeing her in real life in various English homes, country homes, before she got married, and bumped into her from time to time in Kensington Gardens when I would be walking my dog Ronaldo at Whippet.
Right.
And I saw that she could work like a lens and bring people's attention to what I guess a form that I really revived with her in the early 80s, allegory, which is a wonderful combination of a portrait, but also the imagination that you can run wild with the idea of it. And interestingly enough, Elizabeth I was a great exponent of allegorical pictures, and when she was old and rotting, out came still these wonderful portraits of her looking in a new dress. You've seen them all, sure. I'm sure. So I thought, right, I have a focus who's inspiring, extraordinarily beautiful, energetic. She lives right next to me, and I'm just going to include her in allegorical paintings. And that is really what I've done right through. I've probably painted maybe 10 or 12 allegories that involve Princess Diana. I would say also, yes, it's great that Princess Diana is in them, and I couldn't have wanted for a more beautiful, inspirational subject. But she's not the whole thing. The whole thing is much broader, much more imagination is involved in it. Like the one I've done just very recently of her hunting up on the hill where the giant is. And that marvelous giant that is known so well all over the world for his great phallus. To put her up there, I thought this is a really interesting idea. It offered me the opportunity to also show what the giant was about, because it's not a fertility symbol. We have to forget that idea. It's an indicator of the stars and was an indicator of the constellations in the heavens. And since Diana, the actual goddess, had only one love, and he was called Orion, and he ended up immortalized in the sky as the constellation Orion, I thought, this is fantastic. It gives me a chance to get the whole myth in of the real goddess. And all I really have to do is make her look like Diana, our princess.
That idea you fulfilled by painting two particularly notable paintings.
These two
Diana,
that were shown, yeah, the one of them being now at the Eastbury Gallery, okay.
At the Eastbury Hotel. Yes.
And it was very edifying to see it there, because it's in a room that is the right size for it. Mm-hmm. It's huge. I mean, the dining room of the Eastbury is like all the size, the size of the Graham Gallery, which is really tiny.
Yes.
And it just looks spectacular, like it was painted for the wall there.
You did both of these paintings at the church in Longbritton, didn't you?
I did, under the wonderful patronage of Leslie McCready, who's the vicar there. She loves Diana. She said to me very, very interesting things about her. And so I found myself in the right atmosphere to work under, her aegis, so to speak. And also that those extraordinary tombs in the church at Longbourton. I invite anybody to go and have a look at them. They're marvellous. But they link to Diana's family, as they do to the Churchill family.
Why Dorset?
Why Dorset? I suppose it starts with my project manager, a great friend of, we were boys, it seems like, together in London, Graham Smith. And he was living in Dorset. And I came to stay with him. And we explored places like Durdledore, and we went all over. And I said, Graham, this is just such a beautiful place, and there's no cars rushing through it. It seems to have a mystical quality that I just could relate to immediately. And then there was this crop circle that appeared on May 21st of 2017. And I happened to have a call the vicarage in Cernabis and got the wife of the vicar, Jane Still. And she told me about this crop circle. And I wanted to see it so badly. And she said, come, I was in London at the time. She said, come down, come and have a look. And I suppose the adventure in Dorset, the sort of pilgrimage, I begin to think of it as a bit, begins with that crop circle right in Cerne Abbas. In fact, it's depicted in my painting of To the Chase. It's a very prominent part of the composition. Yes. Mm. And so that, I would say, kind of summoned me here, and the gracious invitation of Jane Still to...
And this event took place 20 years on from Diana's death in 2017, last year then. How long did it take you to paint both of these? Well, they're significant works, aren't they? They're big paintings.
Yeah, they're major works. Mm. They're major allegories. They're 72 feet, inches square, sure. Both of them. Sure. And they took me a year because I didn't really finish them until just before they were shown at the Grain Gallery. And I did the finishing touches, so to speak, which are crucial, at the Grain Gallery. The Grain Gallery has a marvelous curator called Sam Branch, who's got a really, he gets great pleasure out of watching me paint. And he was kind of a bit of a muse, really. And I managed to finish the pictures in, probably it took another 3 weeks, in the courtyard during that festival of arts in Dorset. So I had people coming and watching. And yeah, it was all a wonderful experience to finish them off there.
And you must presumably have had people watching you in the earlier stages in the church, did you? Or did you have the
place to yourself? Yes, less so, because the church is quite off the road. And but yes, I had some very, very interesting visitors who...
And you don't mind that?
I love that. I think art should be social, don't you? I mean, yes. I'm not the kind of person... No.
Don't find it distracting.
I don't find it. And you can't distract me. A volcano couldn't distract me when I'm painting.
Exhibition has finished, hasn't it? At the Grain Gallery. Yeah. But one of them is, as you say, at the Eastbury Hotel.
Yeah, and I really do invite anybody to go and see.
And people can just look in and have a look.
They can step in, have a coffee, look at them and see this painting. Mm. Because I'm so proud of it. It looks like the room was designed around it, and many rooms have been designed around my paintings. Mm. But this just seems to work successfully the other way around.
Mm. But ultimately, will you sell these two?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes. Of course. They're both for sale.
Yeah, I see. That must be almost like losing a member of the family, isn't it, after a while?
Well, when I think of the studio right now, here in Sherborne, is full of paintings, I think that if I wanted to keep them all, I don't know where I'd live.
But when you
there'd be no space, Terry.
No. Well, you invest a lot of time in these, don't you?
Yeah, I paint pretty well every day.
I think,
a full long day, from 7 in the morning till 7 at night, easily.
Do you ever get creative block? It's not a writer's block.
Never.
It's a painter's block.
Never. 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 I always... No, the problem is just I feel a little bit like a victim of inspiration. There's always something I want to paint, and there's always something I want to do.
What's next?
Well, I want to paint a couple of paintings for an Italian patron of mine, and they are nudes in a cloister. They're both located, oddly enough, in France, in Saint-Rémy, where very close to... Well, actually, in the asylum where Van Gogh painted The Starry Night. And so I'm going to paint those, and I've got an amazing, really beautiful picture of the Ascension, which takes place here in Dorset. That's been the thing. I've included all Dorset saints. All the models in the paintings are from Dorset, and I found such beautiful models here. all very, you know, wanting to pose. And it's called the Ascension, and it's the Ascension at Saint Altheim. I never can say it. Mm-hmm. It's in right on the coast near Purbeck. I can't. It's ridiculous. I can't pronounce the word. Saint Aldhelm.
Saint Aldhelm's Head.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes, yes, thank you, Terry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's this amazing austere little chapel there.
There is. I've been there. Yes.
Which figures very prominently in the painting, and all the saints are witnessing this Ascension of Jesus Christ, and all the models are Dorset saints, reenacted by Dorset models.
André, it's been fascinating talking to you, and I feel we could do another hour easily, but we can't, so we have to finish.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Terry, speaking
with
you.
Your final track is Barcelona by Freddie Mercury with the wonderful Montserrat Caballé.
Yes, it seemed very me, a crossover of, you know, old and new and classical and pop.
Well, thank you for coming in. It's we wish
pleasure.
You well with your future work, and we look forward to seeing what comes next.
Thank you, Terry. It has really been a pleasure.
We will pop into the Eastbury and have a look.
Do please pop into the Eastbury. Yes. The painting is in the library room, just as you come in the front door.
Yes, lovely.
To the Chase, it's called.
André, thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
I had this perfect dream.
Sueño me volvió.
This dream was me and you. I want all the world to see.
Instinto me guió.
Miracle sensation, my guide and inspiration. Now my dream is slowly coming true. Wind is a gentle breeze.